Today on The Grave Talks, another interview with Laura DiDio, the Amityville Horror Investigation. George and Kathy Lutz knew that the experience they endured that would later be known as the Amityville Horror was all too real. Their drive to be believed and understood led them to an array of paranormal experts, religious figures, and media personalities. On the night of March 6, 1976, reporter Laura DiDio would help to put together a massive team of these personalities to investigate and try to understand exactly what was happening at 112 Ocean Avenue. This would turn out to be a night none of them would ever forget. Members of the Channel 5 camera crew would get violently ill and have visions they couldn't explain. Sensitives would become overwhelmed and be forced to leave. And the spirit of what appears to be the ghost of a little boy was caught on camera. This night would later be dubbed the Amityville Horror Psychic Sleepover.
The Lutzes started inviting people to go into the house that night. Mm-hmm. The folks at Channel 5 invited another reporter from WNEW Radio, which was our affiliate radio station.
Sure.
The Warrens invited a couple of people. So all of a sudden, instead of it just being the Warrens and Channel 5, you know, we had a cast of about 20 people.
Yeah.
Which was not necessarily conducive to a great seance.
Sure. It becomes almost a tour than it does a seance at that point.
Well, yeah. I mean, I remember showing up that night at the house and it was lit up. All the floors were lit up and, Alex Tanaus, who was part of a psychic New York Institute for Psychic Research in Manhattan. He was he looked like almost like a vampire. I didn't know who he was. And he appeared at the one of the side windows there. I almost jumped off the doorstep because he had, you know, hawk-like nose, dark circles under his eyes. I was just so startled.
And in that setting, yeah, it just adds to the mysteriousness.
I had no idea that all of these extra people were going to show up.
Sure.
You know? The other thing that happened was that there was a switch on of reporters. By the way, at Channel 5, the irony about the Amityville coverage on Channel 5, the only ones who were excited about doing this were myself and Mark Monsky. Steve Bauman was not excited about doing this story because he was a serious reporter doing a ghost story, quote unquote, you know, could wreck his reputation. Oh, and by the way, what happened was he suddenly took off for a vacation in one, you know, in Bermuda in mid-afternoon. I didn't know this. Marvin Scott was pressed into service, much to his chagrin, because he and his wife had tickets to go out for months to go to a Broadway show that they had, you know, was sold out for months with friends. Okay, so he wasn't happy. Nobody wanted this. So, you know.
Turns out to be one of the most infamous stories in the history of ghost stories.
Nobody knew
wanted it. Yeah.
This big.
Exactly. Yeah.
When you're, as you know, when you're in the news business,
you have no idea. Yep.
If you're going from one thing to another, after a while, it's especially in New York, it's just another murder, it's just another robbery, it's just another plane crash. Mm-hmm. That's the way you think about it. It's very pedestrian. So Marvin, actually, when I happened to call the station that afternoon at 2 or 3 in the afternoon, asking for Steve Bauman, they said he wasn't around. He had gone on vacation. I said, what do you mean? And at that point, Marvin had grabbed the phone and said, hey, I've just been assigned this story. Tell me everything about it. I know nothing about it. And he was pretty ticked off, you know, because his wife was ready to divorce him all the late nights. And now you're basically cutting out on, we've had these tickets that it took us months to get. And I've been wanting to go to this Broadway show for months. It's been sold out. And now you're canceling on us.
To go to a haunted house.
So, yeah. I know, for a haunted house.
Yeah.
And at that point, it was not that big a story.
Sure.
Again. So when we got there and, you know, more and more people were showing up. Mm-hmm. So it was quite, it was quite the thing. And then what happened, unfortunately, when we did the seance itself, after the seance and we had all of these psychics there that Lorraine had invited. We had one of the psychics ran out of the room, screaming, saying, it's in the second floor bedroom. Somebody else ran out and got sick on the front lawn. I was sitting in between Marvin Scott and Mike Linder. And all of a sudden, at one point, Marvin said to me, hey, I just felt a chill. And then 5 minutes later, Mike Linder said to me, hey, I just felt a chill. Now, in the ensuing years and decades since, when Marvin has talked about it, he says, yeah, at one point during the seance, I felt a little chill. I can tell you that night when Marvin felt the chill, he didn't say, yeah, I felt a little chill. He says, hey, I just felt a chill.
Yeah.
And Marvin has always said he did not. He's felt more afraid watching the movie when the Amityville Horror came out, more afraid with all the kids throwing popcorn and smoking pot in the theater. But one of the things that happened that night of March 6th when we got there that really struck me, and everybody admitted this, was that our cameraman, Steve Petropoulos, he was about 40, he was slim, and in those days, you had a three-man film crew. Cameraman, sound guy, and the lighting guy. And the equipment was much bigger and heavier in those days. Mm-hmm. So the cameraman, those guys had to be in shape. Steve Petropoulos was based in New Jersey. And again, it wasn't a huge story, and he was one of our he wasn't one of our regular staff camera guys. He was one of our regular, like, fourth or fifth guys, so he was a regular stringer for us.
Mm-hmm.
So the camera guys, the film crew arrived at about 10 o'clock, and they Steve Petropoulos started to walk up the stairs to the second floor. That was where everybody, started. There was one spot at the second floor landing where people felt things. But Steve walked up. Steve and I were chatting at the foot of the stairs, and I was introducing him to the different psychics. So Steve says, I'm going to take a look around. And he started to walk up the stairs, and he got five steps up, and he said to myself and Alberta Riley, she was one of the other psychics that Ed and Lorraine Warren had invited, he turns around and he says, there's a room on the second floor the second door on the right, he says, and it's filled with mirrors. And he said to me, I don't know how I know that. Now, I had been in the house before, the week before. That was the master bedroom. That was the DeFeo's bed, you know, Louise and Ronald DeFeo Sr.'s bedroom, where they had been shot. The wall behind their bed had those 12 by 12 mirrored tiles,
mm-hmm.
like in Las Vegas.
Sure.
So I'm like, okay. And again, that really hadn't been in any of the papers. So I don't know how he would know that.
Yeah.
So he then continued up the stairs, and before he reached the landing, just when he gets almost to the top landing, he doubled over in pain. And his face, that, you know, it got red, and then the blood drained out of his face, and he stumbled down the stairs, and we you know, he's clutching his chest, and he said that he's gasping, and he said his heart started to palpitate wildly as though he was having a heart attack, and he doesn't have any history of heart trouble.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we get him some water, and he sat there and calmed down, and it passed. And then no sooner does Steve Petropoulos, our cameraman, recover, then Mary Pascarella, who's another one of the psychics that whose the Warrens had invited, she's taken ill and she feels nauseous and dizzy. So they take her upstairs so she can lie down and rest. So at that point, it's now about 10:45, and we started to gather around the dining room table and to begin the seance. And we've basically got a cross and candles.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple of other people, I think, that the Lutzes, that George Lutz had invited. And that was, they were from Duke University, or that school of parapsychology. And they were sort of skeptical,
mm-hmm.
and were a little, there was some contretemps going on between them and Ed Warren. And Ed basically said to them that those two, that he really didn't want them present because they were challenging the house. And so there was that, you know, there was that going around. But
sure.
We had to hold up the seance for a little bit. This was kind of funny because we had to get the camera, the right camera angles and lighting.
Mm-hmm.
And according to Ed Warren, the candles and the crucifix are there to serve as irritants to antagonize the demonic force. So, again, Ed, in this instance, as Lorraine went into the trance, the light trance state, acts as the guide.
Mm-hmm.
So at first, Lorraine got nothing except a solid, dark mass. And she was speaking slowly. And what it looks like is she appeared, you know, normal, but it looks like she was straining as if she's trying to see a picture unfold on a TV screen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she said, you know, certain people give this the force in the house energy, and she said that George Lutz was one of them. She also said that she saw an older clergyman in a black garb and who uses old rituals, and she said that man would be the one who would be able to rid the house of the force, but it would take him three occasions to do so. And according to Lorraine, George Lutz was spiritually warned to leave the house before personal tragedy could strike he and the rest of his family. And she said that the force would need to be expelled before other people could live in the house in peace. So, then shortly after that, Alberta Riley was speaking at the other end of the table, and that's when she started shouting, "It's upstairs in the bedroom." And then she also was gasping for air and said she had heart palpitations. And then Mary Pascarella said that there was a subtle but pervasive element in the house which affected a tall, thin man who lived there in the late 1800s. And at that point, Ed Warren felt that the psychics extended themselves enough, and he halted the seance. And then we had somebody else bolt out of their seat and stumble out of the room and vomit, you know?
Yeah.
So by midnight, after the seance had ended, people basically dispersed into different groups and exploring, you know, other regions of the house. And Marvin said to me, we were upstairs, and he says, "I don't think we have it." You know, because Marvin knew, as I knew, when, you know, for television, what you're looking for is something akin to poltergeist.
Sure.
And as I've always said, just because you've got a camera crew there doesn't mean that ghosts, spirits, demonic forces are going, you know, they're not card-carrying members of AFTRA.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to show up and perform on command. You know, just because we're there for 2 or 3 hours.
Sure.
You know, Lorraine also thought, by the way, at the time, that the negative force that was at the Amityville house was able to operate through inanimate objects. Mm-hmm. And she did point out the figure of the ceramic lion and pictures on the wall. So we did go upstairs into the second floor bedroom. And the sewing room, and Marvin did try and conduct another mini seance with Lorraine in the sewing room, because Lorraine felt that the sewing room was the source of a lot of evil.
Mm-hmm.
But again, if nothing's going to happen, what it looks like for the television cameras is that you're sitting around talking in a dimly lit room.
Sure.
You know.
This is the night where the ghost boy photo comes up, correct?
At some point, yes.
Okay.
I mean, because, again, the Warrens had that fellow that they worked with, Paul Bartz,
mm-hmm.
who was in a plaid shirt. And the ghost boy photo, there's, you know, the boy in the photo, whoever that was also in a plaid shirt.
Because there's some argument, correct, that it may have just been him on his knees or something, kind of looking over and looking up, and then the light catching his eye. And there's also the argument that it could be one of the DeFeo children.
And there's been a lot of speculation about who or what it who or what it could have been.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have no idea. I can't vouch for it being true. I can't vouch for it being fake, mm-hmm. because I wasn't there when the picture was developed.
Sure.
I'm as mystified as anybody else. It didn't look like any of the DeFeo kids to me. I mean, Mark or John, that would have to be who it was. It clearly was not Ronnie Jr.
Sure.
I don't know. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, it looks like Paul Bartz. I didn't really think it looked like Paul Bartz either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anything. Who knows? You know, to me, it's a big question mark. And if it was a fake, who faked it?
Yeah.
So, that's, you know, who, I don't know who developed the pictures.
Yeah.
I heard third, fourth, fifth hand that, now nobody's contacted Paul Bartz. I don't know where he is. But I heard third, fourth, or fifth hand a long time ago that somebody allegedly called Paul Bartz and asked him if he developed it. And was it fake? And he said, you know, I'm not saying anything. So I don't know. But and nobody knows where Paul Bartz is.
Sure.
I've never spoken to him since then.
This adds to the more mystery around the whole case.
As you know, the best time to affirm the validity and do your fact checking and track something down is in the immediate aftermath of an incident. Whether you're, you know, trying to find out about a traffic incident, a robbery, a murder, or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
It's been, you know, 1976 is, you know, you're going back 43 years.
Yeah.
Many of the principals have passed on, including, you know, George and Kathy Lutz. And, of course, you know, sadly, Lorraine Warren passed away just a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
So the trail gets cold.
Sure.
In talking to, of course, Danny Lutz, Christopher and his brother, Christopher Quarantino, they still to this day are very definitive in saying that these things happened to them.
Yeah. And that's an interesting, almost a new chapter to the story that we've seen in recent years with the documentary My Amityville Horror and Danny speaking about his truth and what he believes happened to him in that house, and Christopher also coming out now and speaking more than he had in the past. Everything with allegations, many allegations against George. George obviously not around anymore to defend himself. But there's, of course, allegations out there for our listeners who don't know of abuse. There's allegations of George being involved with occult practices or transcendental meditation and many other things as well. What was your knowledge of any of that stuff at the time when you were the reporter working on this case? I mean, I'm guessing you probably didn't know anything about the allegations of abuse, but as far as George being involved in anything occult or anything of that nature?
Well, I think what George always said to me was that at the time was that, you know, he was sort of a non-practicing Methodist.
Yeah.
And when this happened to him, Kathy was brought up as a devout Irish Catholic. George was sort of a non-practicing Methodist. And when this happened to him, he told me he began to research everything he could, taking a crash course in the occult.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, he had a lot of books on, you know, everything from Padre Pio, the very famous, priest who was, you know, a mystic.
Sure.
Who famously had the stigmata, Christ's wounds from the cross.
Yeah.
To the Fatima apparitions, to, he had books there on, you know, ghostly apparitions and hauntings, etc. And Danny had said that, you know, and Christopher had both told me that George would be practicing occult rituals out in the garage and things like this and telekinesis. And, you know, to that, I would say, you know, you and I could get bell, book, and candle.
Sure.
Anybody could try and practice that. That doesn't mean we're going to be successful.
Sure.
So, I think that might be, you know, rather far-fetched.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I could try and do a spell and incantation, but this is not, you know, Charmed.
Yeah, sure, sure.
What can you say? As for abuse, I mean, you have to put this into context. Danny was six when his parents got divorced. Christopher would have been four. And Missy would have been, what, two?
Yeah.
So a divorce, especially going back to the mid-70s, that's, divorce is traumatic in any event for kids.
Sure.
Danny was a very, very strong-willed little boy, and he was very, very close to his mother. And Christopher was a much, and is a much gentler personality.
Mm-hmm.
Danny wasn't going to like any stepfather that came in. So if you see those, Danny is a very intense person. What you see in those posters with those ice blue eyes is what you get.
Yeah.
And I'm sure if you saw My Amityville Horror, Danny lays it on the line.
He does, yeah.
He, you know, he makes no bones about the fact that he did not like George, and he was not going to back down. And so George came in, and he was the stepfather, and George did say that the house worked on his personality. And he said that he became like a drill sergeant ordering the kids around. So in the context of today, that might be considered a form of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Do I think that he was beating the kids with belts and things like that? You know, holding their feet to the fire? No. But, and certainly he treated the girl, Missy, differently from the boys. So there's no doubt that he clashed with Danny big
sure.
time.
Sure.
And Danny reciprocated that. Christopher, you know, was not going to clash as openly with him. But yeah, I mean, he was going to be a disciplinarian.
Mm-hmm. And Chris, in recent years, speaking out more and more about what went on, and in some words or less, he's alluded to there being much more to the story than the public is even aware of, or that's been told yet. And obviously, he was, you know, one of the few people that are still around that were in the house when these things were going on, but that allusion to, there's more that no one knows about yet, and I'm not quoting directly, but just roughly what he said, that he wants to share when the time is right, essentially. Do you have any sense as to what he's referring to when he makes claims like that or makes statements like that?
Well, I only know what they've said publicly, yeah, and what they've said to privately to, you know, myself and, you know,
sure,
and the Warrens over the years. You know, I mean, certainly they saw some horrifying things. I mean, Danny had said, and he said it in my Amityville Horror, mm-hmm, he and his mother were sitting in the kitchen and they felt a, you know, they saw, you know, a figure come into the kitchen. He felt something go right through him almost.
Yeah.
He also said he and Christopher were in the upstairs third floor bedroom that belonged to Ronnie DeFeo Jr.
Mm-hmm.
They saw that sort of black figure,
mm-hmm,
you know, come into their room. That would be rather terrifying.
Sure.
You know, and of course, I guess they found some of the stash of Ronnie DeFeo's drugs or,
oh well,
you know, paraphernalia,
yeah,
in the closet there.
Sure.
And there was the incident of the beds levitating.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, I'm not sure, but all of those things were, you know, that would be enough to terrify me.
Those are pretty big in themselves. I'm very fascinated.
I mean,
yeah, I've been trying to,
you know, and I've heard allusions to the fact that those ceramic lions supposedly moved, a la, you know, Stephen King's The Shining.
Yeah.
So there have been any number of things, mm-hmm, over the years. But again, the only one who has steadfastly stayed out of the public eye and doesn't talk at all is Missy. And she was the one who had the story about, you know, Jody, the,
sure,
the pig. Now, Missy, of course, was only 5 years old. She had not yet reached the age of reason, which is generally considered to be 7.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, when we did My Amityville Horror, Eric Walter put that all together, and I was a producer on that, and mm-hmm, I interviewed Danny. We had Eric Walter got a top, you know, top-notch psychologist to talk to Danny, and they came away, you know, convinced that, you know, Danny was not lying.
Yeah.
You know, the way the psychologist put it was that, you know, he believes all of this. Now, I don't think that Danny is delusional.
No.
And the other thing is, Danny, you know, Danny was 9 when this happened. A lot of people say he was 10, but he was 9. And the reason I take pains to point this out is that there's a big difference developmentally from 9 to 10.
Sure.
It's not like being 30 or 31. So that's a lot for him, you know, to go through.
Yeah.
And certainly, I think his wife, by the way, when Danny got married and had 2 kids, his wife didn't even know that he was the quote unquote kid from the Amityville Horror until she went to a video store one night to rent a video. And she was renting the Amityville Horror, and she saw his name on the back of it, and she said, "Is that you?"
What a way to find out.
Exactly. And I think in a lot of ways, when he did Danny left home in his teens, and they were living in, after the Lutzes, George and Kathy, got divorced, Danny left Arizona and he came back to New York. So he separated himself from that. He basically locked that whole experience away. And it wasn't until he did the Miamityville Horror documentary,
mm-hmm,
going back to 2011, you know, when we were filming that he unlocked the door to that. And I think that let it all out again.
Yeah.
That wraps up the first part of our conversation. Part two for you tomorrow, right here on the feed. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss that. If you want ad-free access to all of our episodes, simply sign up through Apple Podcasts. Even try it for 3 days free and binge away with no commercials. You'll also get advanced access to all of our episodes well before they're released to the public, all commercial free. Apple Podcasts, check it out. Or patreon.com/thegravetalks. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening to The Grave Talks.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.